Hi, I'm Julie Almacher. This is my extended conversation with violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter, who's celebrating her 40th anniversary as a performer this year, and she's doing so with the release of a new recording as a 2-CD set called Mutterissimo. I hope you enjoy it. Anna-Sophie, you're celebrating a 40-year career this year, and when you think about that, what surprises you the most?
That there is so much repertoire out there which I haven't studied yet. And although I'm constantly studying not only contemporary repertoire, but you know, works by Beethoven and Brahms, it just is never-ending, particularly if you look into the pile of chamber music. I mean, the upcoming big Beethoven year also brings me closer to his string quartets, which are some of the really later works. And for me as a soloist, it's a great privilege to dive into that part of Beethoven's life, because he's only written one violin concerto, so the chamber music is really a way to get closer and cover more grounds over a more extended period of a composer's life.
Do you have plans to do more Beethoven for that anniversary year?
Yes, absolutely. I will include some of his late string quartets into my repertoire, but couple that with a piece yet to be written by Jörg Widmann, a very popular German composer, just to give an outlook, the stretch from the 1800s into the 21st century, and what a composer of our days is going to do with four string instruments. I think it will be a very interesting bridge between the centuries.
I would love if you could try to summarize your professional philosophy.
Music is not there to bring artists about who perfect their skills, and it's all about them. Music, in the greater sense of it, is really a bridge builder between the many different cultural roots we have around the world, thanks to God. I think music is even more important in order to really appreciate the richness of different cultures we are having. And with music, you can also really hands-on contribute to the greater good of society. Lambert and I, we have played for orphanages in Romania, for Artists Against AIDS, for victims of Fukushima, victims of earthquakes. I mean, you name it. And I think that really shows how important, in a small sense, but better than nothing, a musician's life can be for society outside of performing on stage.
I'm curious how playing the violin became so important to you, especially at such a young age. Weren't you, I don't know, 6 years old or something when you had your first public performance?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was in conjunction with a competition I won after I had having started half a year the violin. I was always totally transposed by the different sounds and emotions you could evoke, the colors you were able to hear in a great performer's violin sound, like Menuhin. I grew up with Menuhin's recordings. And then, of course, I totally got stuck with the instrument once I played it, because the physical sensation of being like a sound sculpture with a string instrument is something which has never left me untouched. And at the very early stage, my mother also, she informed me that Yehudi Menuhin was the first Jewish musician coming back to Germany after the Second World War. And I suddenly also understood what music can mean in the greater sense of, you know, touching people and bringing people together. So that was, of course, part of the whole equation of wanting to become a musician.
I wanted to just backtrack a little bit about that performance when you were 6 years old in your hometown. I read a charming story about how you got a little bit distracted during that performance. Would you share that, please?
Yes, there was this. Are you aiming at the golden shoes?
Yes, I am.
Yes. Okay. And, you know, two things happened after that. First of all, after getting transfixed by these golden shoes, mind you, I grew up at the foot of the Black Forest, so there was really nothing exotic there. And these golden shoes, they definitely caught my eye. And I got slightly lost in my performance. So as a result, two things happened. First of all, I really like it dark in the hall now. And secondly, I'm a great shoe fan.
So no distractions while you're on stage, if possible. Well, then when you came to prominence for the first time on the world stage, you were 13, and that was at the Lucerne Festival. And I'm wondering what you remember about that experience that you could share.
I did a recital with my brother, Christoph, who meanwhile turned into being a lawyer, not a profi musician. It was a very hot afternoon, bad acoustics. I almost tripped over a carpet, and that's pretty much all I remember. And after that, you know, people kind of, you know, called in, and that concert actually also triggered that invitation by Herbert von Karajan to audition for him, and subsequently led to my debut at the Whitsun Festival in 1977 with Herbert von Karajan and the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. And that concert was the beginning of a 13-year-old collaboration until Karajan's death. And of course, you know, the time where I had the great fortune to start to concertize with all the wonderful musicians out there.
Now, speaking of wonderful young musicians, you were one of them, growing into an amazing talent who has inspired other young musicians, and you have a foundation to help do that. Tell me a little bit about that foundation.
My foundation is celebrating its 20th anniversary, and we are working in aid of young string players actually worldwide. It is also mainly about the tutoring of these youngsters. It's about bringing them together with great colleagues, having them audition for conductors to start not only musical collaboration, but just also a musical dialogue to learn from the ones who usually are very difficult to get to. Most importantly, also in some cases, we were able to buy instruments which became life partners for these young violinists, violists, cellists, and bass players. And we give commissions, which I think is a rather unusual aspect of a foundation, particularly in light of the fact that the double bass is not looked upon that much in repertoire as a solo instrument, because it is the foundation of the symphonic repertoire, rightfully so. But if you have a great artist playing the double bass, it can be quite exciting. So people like Sebastian Carrier, Wolfgang Riem, Andre Previn have written wonderful scores for double bass and violin, and we are trying to expand the repertoire further.
Now, I know that it's also important to you that young musicians become very broad-minded human beings. What's the best way to help them approach that so that they don't get too single-minded in their efforts?
I think part of the philosophy is that one should always try, first of all, not to be a soloist per se, but try to be a musician, a broad-minded musician. And with that, I mean, not only trying to be a good violinist, but as a musician, you have to see the bigger picture. You really are part of the bigger picture, even in the solo repertoire, really deep digging into what the orchestra's main voices are and understanding that chamber music, like the way Lambert Orkus and myself, Lambert is sitting next to me, are doing since 29 years. It is really sharing each other's musical ideas. And, you know, you just have to leave your ego and your wish for fortune and fame, forget it, at the doorstep. You are a servant of the music. And then literature never hurts to know that, and culture in general, and looking around in the world where you could help with benefit concerts, for example, being part of the world and its many problems, and trying to see a way that music can bring not only people together, but for the greater good. You can work on projects together and build orphanages, for example, and just be a person who is useful to human society. I think that at the end of the day is what a musician needs to be.
So when you are in a concert hall, and you've been in the concert hall now for some 40 years, I know you've seen some changes, or you wish there would be some changes in the way the audience is responding or maybe interacting. Can you talk about that a little bit? How could we become a little bit more relaxed and spontaneous to be a little bit more involved rather than perhaps maybe being too worried about the rules in the concert hall?
You know, first of all, people who have taken the time to come to a concert, it's just wonderful to carve out that time to make the effort to schlep yourself somewhere at the end of a long working day. And I'm one of many musicians who appreciates that greatly, understanding that the impact of a live performance is quite different from, of course, the luxury to have music available at any time, anywhere, at home. But a live performance is really something which is so much different from going to the cinema, because it's once in a lifetime and the next evening it will be different. I'm not so much worried about people sometimes worrying, you know, how to behave and if they want to applaud after a first movement and they don't dare to. More spontaneity wouldn't hurt. But I'm more and more thinking of creating a second venue to the proper concert hall, which always will have its place, and the second venue would be more like in a club atmosphere. Lambert Orkus and I, we did this live from the club project in a small venue in Berlin, where there were young people, not really affiliated with classical music, standing around us, some 300 or 400, you know, very excitable and very relaxed in that atmosphere where it didn't count what you would wear or how you would behave. You just would be you, and the artists would talk to them. And I think that would be nice to have that second leg, so to speak, because we need to address and reach an audience which just feels uncomfortable in the more tight and regulated atmosphere of a concert hall.
Well, I wondered if that may be one of the reasons on your new recording, it's a 2-CD set, Muterissimo, why there are a number of live performances that you chose to have featured.
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, even if it's not advertised as a live performance, much of what Lambert and I, and also myself as a soloist, have recorded is, if not live from a concert, taken in such a context that it's basically a run-through. I just hate to repeat for the sake of what you might call technical perfection. In my opinion, a concert has to be so well, you know, executed that it could be recorded anytime and vice versa. A recording is nothing else really than a snapshot of a performance. So that live character must be kept alive under any circumstances of recording. And that's why I consider almost all my recordings done in that spirit, which I find really important.
Now, I know there's also a few pieces here that were recorded live from Yellow Lounge, and that is a more relaxed environment, as you were referring to.
Exactly. That's the cool place.
Yeah, and some exciting energy. I made note of the Schubert Bagatelles, for example. Tell me a little bit about those settings and how they impacted perhaps your performance.
The Yellow Lounge in Berlin, yeah, I wanted to also introduce my group, Mutters Virtuosi, which is a small string ensemble growing out of my work with the youngsters, the scholars of my foundation. And so we played short excerpts out of the Four Seasons and also Bach Double Concerto with ever-changing second fiddles. Then Lambert and I played transcriptions by Heifetz, which are great fun. It's a repertoire which, at least in Europe, gets kind of overlooked and forgotten. Such fun pieces as the Jamaican Rumba by Arthur Benjamin, an Australian composer. Or a Tchaikovsky melody, you know, transcribed by Heifetz. And it was wonderful to play that for that very young and very excitable audience, and then have short talks and even introductions to the pieces in between. And that was one of the really best moments, actually, of my life. And I think everybody involved, Lambert and also my youngsters, were quite excited and touched by that spontaneous and very, very heartfelt emotional response of the audience.
Now I'm looking at the list on the second CD where we see the Yellow Lounge pieces, and I was struck how we hear Clair de Lune from Debussy followed by that Jamaican rumba. So there was a real diverse repertoire presented as well.
Yes, of course. We had two sets of, I think, 30 minutes, like you would have in a jazz club. And of course, we aimed at diversity. And transcriptions can be, you know, quite fun and wonderful. But of course, Clair de Lune as a solo piano piece as it was intended is definitely, musically speaking, the stronger piece. But that evening was not about musicological nose frowning. It was just about the diversity of classical music and the diversity of emotional messages you could present in such a short time.
So now I know that you selected the pieces that are on this new 2-CD set. How challenging was that?
I really tried to, as the bridge also suggests on the cover of the CD, the bridge, which is part of the violin, so to speak, of the setup of the violin, where the four strings run over. And the bridge itself, of course, is, you know, the bridging between the centuries of music and history. I was going for diversity, and of course I try to avoid, if possible, any doubles with other albums, which over the past 40 years have also coupled repertoire. So it's basically really a collection of music of different eras. You have Stravinsky, you have Bach, you have Korngold, you have Gershwin, trying to give a huge broad picture to an audience who might only be able to, you know, invest 5, 10, 15 minutes of a given day into classical music. And hopefully from there we'll be interested to hear the bigger picture of that piece.
Just say I only had 5 minutes and I was going to pop the first CD in the CD player. What piece should I listen to first?
I think the beginning actually is quite smashingly great. It's the Korngold Violin Concerto, and one has to consider that Korngold was, of course, a great prodigy, and he had to flee Germany during the Second World War, and he went to Hollywood and became a very famous film composer. And then after the Second World War, came back to Europe and had terrible problems to live with that stigma. In Europe, people are strange when it comes to film composers, you know, because the general thinking is that film music is second-rate music, which of course is total nonsense. So when Heifetz asked Korngold to write a concerto for him, Korngold really was rather cold-blooded. He basically opened his drawer and took film scores he already had done and you know, pasted them together, and out came this amazingly beautiful and incredibly difficult violin concerto. And I think it's one can find anything one is looking for in music in that first movement. Drama, beauty, emotions, virtuosity, lushness of orchestration. I mean, it's really paramount music.
I know coming up on May 27th, you're going to be joining guest conductor Ricardo Muti and the Berlin Philharmonic to mark your 40th anniversary of your first performance with that orchestra. What are you most looking forward to?
Just the concert itself, you know, and it's actually fun coming back to that wonderful orchestra, and I feel a little bit like a dinosaur because there's no one left from the Karajan era. And there I am, you know, still standing upright and being able to walk. Joke aside, I've played the Tchaikovsky Concerto with Ricardo Muti quite a bit, and I'm also very happy that we will open the season in Chicago this autumn with the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And being back in Berlin is a thrill. The hall is perfect. The audience, very young, you know, and the orchestra keeping, like any great orchestra, actually, keeping the tradition alive when needed. You know, all these wonderfully long-spun musical arches and phrasing and the sound they can produce. In art, I think nothing really ever dies. It's an ever renewing cycle of information and emotional input of generations of musicians having worked with ensembles, and then the ensemble members will, in this case the orchestra, will pass on the knowledge of that time to the next generation to come.
Well, speaking of passing on knowledge, you have 2 children, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And I'm wondering what you feel is one of the most important lessons that you have passed on to them.
That's a very good question. Let's ask them. I really don't know. I see as one of the more important points, other than, of course, ethics of empathy and respect for each other and trying to be a person who is reaching out to others and appreciating different cultures and having traveled a lot and speaking languages and, you know, trying to be part of a big picture, having a sense for environment and the duty of it. My son is studying law, and you know, I would of course love him to be a human rights lawyer or something in environment. But anyhow, the bigger picture really of being a parent, I think, is also to help a child to find their main gift or their calling in life and facilitate the way towards that. You know, they are 23 and 25, so in the midst of their studies. And I hope I'm reasonably helpful.
That's violinist Anna-Sophie Mutter talking about her 40-year career and her newest recording, Mutterissimo. And that's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher.